I wanted to begin with a question which is on our screens there. Doesn't the church's weakness indicate that the devil is winning? And it's a fair question, isn't it? If God were real, we think, if Jesus really has been raised from the dead to rule the world, as Christians claim, surely we would expect the church to be in a better state than it's in, wouldn't we? Maybe you've articulated this question, maybe you've had it lurking somewhere below the surface. And partly it's the issue of the church is irrelevant. Surely it would be more credible and have greater cultural traction and influence, wouldn't it, if God was in charge? Partly there's the weakness of the church in terms of how it's so often compromised. It's often embroiled in immorality or in just blending in with the culture around it. And partly there's the way Christians across the world are so often persecuted and even martyred for their faith. Open Doors, who hold to the narrowest definition of what counts as a Christian martyr, they state that 11 Christians are killed every day across the world, specifically for their decision to follow Jesus. So it certainly feels like the devil has the upper hand most of the time. And actually, that was one of the big issues probably for this, the recipients of this prophecy of Revelation. Lots of us studied the first five chapters in small groups last term, and we discovered that the seven churches to whom this prophecy was sent were marked by weakness and compromise and persecution very often. And in particular, they were told explicitly that it was the devil who was the one who was responsible for lots of it. So, for example, the church in Smyrna, they were told the devil is about to throw some of you into prison. He's the one behind your persecution. Or the church in Thyatira, who were falling into sexual immorality and idolatry. They were warned against these things because they are the deep things of Satan. So we discover that Satan is behind both the tyranny and the temptation that the church experiences. That Satan's behind both the kicks and the kisses, both of which cause real trouble for the church. And so you could well understand why these hearers might be asking this question: is the devil winning? Because it certainly feels like it on the ground. And of course, it's into that situation that we get this vision in chapter 12. And it's a glimpse behind the scenes, the curtains pulled back, and we get to see what's really going on in the world beneath the surface. And the first, and this is the main thing that John's vision reveals to us, and we're going to spend longest on this, is point one, I've put there on the screens, that Satan looks unstoppable, but actually he's been decisively beaten. So let me pick up from verse 1 of chapter 12. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon. Some of us were here and we got to hear Andrew Satch preach on this passage for a carol service a couple of years ago. And he and John Gemmell, off the back of that, they wrote this wonderful little book called The Weirdest Nativity, which I definitely recommend if you want to get more detail on this chapter than you're going to get today. And it really is a very weird nativity scene, isn't it? There's the baby, whom we discover is Jesus, and he's about to be born. And there, straight away, is the dragon, Satan, ready to attack. And the graphic on the screen is the nativity scene on the back of the dragon's scales. And before we go on, I thought I'd just spend a few minutes. It's probably worth us tackling this whole question, which some of us are asking right now, about Satan. Are we really, as 21st century Londoners, are we expected to believe in a personal devil? Some of us think this is a bit primitive, perhaps a bit naive. Well, there's a book by a secular liberal professor called Andrew DelBanco called The Death of Satan. I haven't read the book, but I've read lots about it and the reviews. And the argument of the book is that Western reductionism just doesn't work. And DelBanco says the problem is illustrated for him in a scene in the film The Silence of the Lambs. And in this scene, the FBI agent approaches this imprisoned madman, Hannibal Lecter, this guy who eats his own victims. And she says to him, what made you like this? What happened to you? And he's saying that, look, we in the West, we have this reduced view of reality. Everything has to be boiled down to either a social or a psychological explanation. Everything's medicalized. It becomes dysfunction rather than plain wickedness. And in this scene, Hannibal Lecter looks at the FBI agent and he says, nothing has happened to me, Officer Starling. I happened. You can't reduce me to a set of influences. Can't you stand to say I'm evil? And Del Banco says, the modern West cannot answer the monster's question. People used to argue that racism and violence came from a lack of education and privilege. But of course, then we had the Holocaust, which arose out of a culture as educated as any culture on earth. Also in the 20th century, we had Marxism, which argued that our problem is social, or if you could just put the means of production into the hands of the workers, everything will be okay. But of course, when that happened, the workers were every bit as violent and repressive as the capitalists. And the whole system didn't work. So Western reductionism, Del Banco argues, can't account for the depth and the pervasiveness of evil in the human heart. Whereas, of course, the Bible's teaching, which explains that there is real supernatural evil, there is a real devil, there is real evil in the human heart. Actually, this teaching is far less naive and it provides a much better explanation for the world we see around us. So that was a couple of minutes just to think about this whole issue. But let's get back into the text again. And one of the things we discover about the devil in this chapter is his strength. Did you notice there in verse 3? He's described as a great red dragon, 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. So he's wearing all these crowns of authority. And verse 4, his tail swept down 1/3 of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. He's immensely powerful. And later in verse 9, he's described as the deceiver of the whole world. I think that's a fascinating phrase because it tells you that he's got this universal global reach, but also that his power is based on deception. Of course, the lies are going to vary from culture to culture, but he's an expert at keeping humanity deceived about God and about his purposes. He certainly looks unstoppable in this scene. But as the second part of our heading says, actually, he's been decisively beaten. And next in the passage, we're reminded of his track record in his conflicts with Jesus. So look at verse 4 again. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And immediately we're taken back in the Bible story to the events around Jesus' birth and Herod's terrible massacre of the infants back in Bethlehem, in that attempt to kill Jesus right at the beginning of his life. And bloody as it was, Satan's attempts to devour the child completely failed. And verse 5 describes it like this. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And here's a little reminder of a place in the Old Testament, Psalm 2, which described that God is never thrown by opposition. His plan that his king will rule will never be diverted. And then it says this, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And this vision is strange, isn't it? Because it actually jumps over all the other crucial events of Jesus' life and death and resurrection. And it takes us straight to the ascension. And it reminds us that ultimately Jesus was kept safe from all of the devil's attacks right across his whole life, enabling him to complete everything that God planned for him right through until he ascended into heaven and was safe there. The devil was beaten. And then having seen this overview of Jesus' life, the middle paragraph of this chapter, which is verses 7 to 12, it zooms in on the decisive defeat of Satan, the one that happened at the cross. And it's expressed here as a kind of military conquest. So let's pick up from verse 7. Now war arose in heaven. Michael, he's an angel who's referenced in Daniel 10, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. So we're given this window into a conflict going on in heaven, but of course it's very short-lived, verse 9, or verse 8. But he, the dragon, was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them, that's the dragon and his angels, in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down. That ancient serpent who's called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And of course, we're wondering, you know, what's this talking about? What's the event being described when all this took place? And verse 10 gives us a very big clue, because it says, "And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God." If you know the book of Job in the Old Testament, in that book we're introduced to a meeting of the heavenly council. It's a cabinet meeting. And Satan is present at that meeting in heaven, and he makes accusations before God against Job. And actually Satan does something very similar in Zechariah 3 against the high priest Joshua. The very name Satan means accuser, and that's what he keeps doing. He's armed with this powerful argument, and the argument runs a little bit like this. He says, "Lord God, Andrew Latimer," fill in your name, "Andrew Latimer is a sinner. He deserves condemnation. He deserves punishment from you. And it would be unjust for you, God of the whole world, to overlook his sin." And human beings know something of this accusation in our own lives. All of us do, in our consciences. Ever since our first ancestors sinned, we've felt this need to cover our nakedness, cover our shame. And we've developed all kinds of false solutions to this problem. And I'm going to list just a few here. I mean, probably the most obvious one is religion. Like the tens of millions of Hindus who on the right festival day all wash in the Ganges River, hoping that somehow this water is going to cleanse them of their sins. Another is to just try and minimize the force of the accusation. And we can do that by comparison. So we comfort ourselves, at least we're not as bad as them. Or we do it by blame shifting. You know, the real problem is my family or my ex or, you know, whoever else I can pin the blame on. Or we do it by rationalizing. This is a popular one. We try and convince ourselves that this feeling of accusation is the product of some primitive judgmental upbringing, and therefore all we need to do is just try and convince ourselves that right and wrong don't really exist, and hopefully that's going to fix it. Or perhaps another one is we find a priest or we find a therapist to tell us everything's okay. And of course, ingenious as these solutions are, none of them make any difference in heaven. None of them deal with Satan's case before God. Satan's case is very strong. It seems like it's watertight. Until, of course, the Lord Jesus, the slain lamb, appears in heaven and he deals with the argument. And he says this, "Objection, Your Honor. Yes, I concede that my client," fill in your name, "Andrew Latimer, has sinned grievously. And it's true, he really is deserving of everything the accuser has suggested and more. But when I died on the cross, I took all of that condemnation, I took all that penalty on myself, and I took it right down, and it's buried in the grave. And when I was raised up from the grave, from the dead, and declared righteous, that declaration justified, I now share with all my people. And so from now on, the accuser has no case left against my client." And wonderfully, we discover in these verses that our accuser doesn't just lose the case, he's completely barred from any further appearances in court against Jesus' people. There will be no appeal process. Why? Well, it's in that verse we looked at, verse 10. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, smacked down. Satan has been decisively beaten. And that means, it doesn't mean that accusations won't still come at us on earth. There'll be accusations from people, hostile people, which we'll come to in a moment. There'll be accusations from our own consciences. But of course, when those accusations come, we know what to do with them. We just reply, yes, but no, but. Yes, it's true. I am filthy. It's true that just for the sins of today, it means I am deserving of condemnation before you, before God. But no, no, none of that is going to change my acceptance, my welcome with God. There's a beautiful verse that captures this in Romans 8. Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Get lost, Satan. It doesn't work anymore. We're going to sing in a moment a hymn which tells us exactly what to do at those moments when Satan tempts me to despair and tells me of the guilt within. And can I really recommend we just learn that song and sing it loudly when the accusations come. It tells us exactly what to do. So Satan has been completely beaten. But the question is, why does it so often not feel that way in our world? And that brings us on to verse 12. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. You see, the first hearers of this prophecy were very aware that Satan's attacks were real. They were facing satanic seduction. They were facing satanic spite. And there was worse to come. But here they discover that the ferocity of Satan's attacks in this age, that is not a sign of his strength. It's a sign of his weakness. It's his desperation coming out. He's like an injured animal. He knows he's been beaten. He's on borrowed time. And that is what accounts for his fierceness. And can I say, what a difference discovering this makes in our Christian fight? One of the devil's chief weapons, of course, is deception. He loves to persuade us that he reigns supreme and that resistance to him is going to be useless. And he uses this tactic again and again in different areas. For example, he uses it when we're facing hostility. So maybe it's hard to be a Christian at school. You know, at church, they're always saying Jesus is Lord. But in my classroom, it does not feel like that at all. When I'm asked after the RE lesson if I agree that all religions are equally valid and I say, no, I don't believe that's true. In the real world of the schoolyard or social media, as I'm being excluded, as I'm being bad-mouthed, it feels like popularity is Lord. It feels like any resistance is useless. Or in my office, for some of us. You know, if I stand up for the truth at work, if I call out that practice as something I can't go along with, or I tell my boss I can't sign up to whatever the diversity policy says I now have to celebrate, in the real world of the workplace, it feels like it's HR who's Lord. It feels like the CEO who's Lord. And yet Revelation chapter 12 says, don't believe it. The devil is all talk and no trousers. He wants us to think resistance is futile, but that's because he's already lost. He's on borrowed time and bluff is all he's got left. Don't buy into his lies. Jesus is Lord. And he uses the same tactic again and again when we're battling sin. You know, he says, you may as well give up. You're never going to break this habit. Resistance is useless. He loves that line. And we say back to him, no, it's not. Resist the devil and he will flee, the Bible says. He is all bluff. Jesus is Lord, not Satan. And we are not to keep falling for his same lies every time. Now, that is the big take-home point, I think, from Revelation 12. Satan looks unstoppable, but actually, he has been decisively beaten. And it's right that we therefore, I think we spent the longest time on that one. But there are three other much smaller, quicker points we need to notice more briefly. And number two is this. Believers keep losing, but actually every loss is really a victory. Now, of course, Jesus is the victor. He's the one who decisively conquered Satan. He's the one whose blood conquered at the cross. But in verse 11, the emphasis here is on how Christians are to do the conquering. Did you notice that in verse 11? Let me put it up. It says this, and they, which is talking about Christians, they have conquered him, the accuser. How have they done it? By the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. And if you're with us for chapters 2 and 3 in our Bible studies, you'll have noticed that conquering is what all believers are called to do. In Revelation, each of the seven letters ends, to him who conquers, to him who conquers. And here we discover more about how it is that this conquering happens. So imagine now you were in that church at Pergamum, and Antipas, he was your, you know, small group leader, something like that. And he just got martyred for his faith. He just got conquered by Satan, as chapter 11, verse 7 puts it. And every time an Antipas from your church was killed, you know, another martyr, it would feel, wouldn't it, like another victory for Satan. In the real world, it certainly looks like the persecutors have won in the end. That's what we think. But now we read chapter 12, verse 11, and it's telling us that at the very moment that believer is being conquered, at the moment, you know, we take the hit at work, at the moment, you know, in the classroom, we take the hit, at the moment we show we trust in Jesus, even when it's costly, wonderfully, that is the very moment when we are conquering Satan, according to this verse. Isn't that wonderful? The picture just there on your screen is from the film Braveheart. It's William Wallace. Now, I don't know really what William Wallace said in real life, but at least in the film, he famously shouts out, "They may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom." And what's so powerful about that speech is, you know, so he's on the front line leading his troops into battle. He's telling his countrymen, so long as we're faithful, so long as we stick to our guns, stick to our principles, actually, it doesn't really matter if we win or lose the battle today. Actually, the Scots did win their battle yesterday, but we won't talk about that. But he's saying, look, either way, however the battle today goes, we are still conquerors. Freedom is still the winner. That's what he's trying to say. And this verse, verse 11, is written so that you and I can have that same kind of conviction etched into our souls. Christians, stay faithful. Then whether you lose your job or not, whether you lose your reputation or not, whether you lose your friendship group or not, whether you lose your life or not, you are still a conqueror. You've won. And of course, not every believer is called to be an Antipas, but every believer is called to be ready to be an Antipas if required. This is basically definitional of what a Christian is in the Gospels. Think of John 12:25, whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. That's what a Christian is. And when we get to the end of Revelation chapter 21, in the end, there are only two groups. There are those who conquer and inherit the promises, and there are those who suffer the second death in the lake of fire. So this is very, very important for us to settle in our own hearts. I used to race dinghies when I was smaller, and there I am in that picture trying to pass on this activity to the next generation quite a few years ago. And one of the things my dad used to tell me before a race was to do a quick capsize drill. So what you do is you flip the boat over, then you flip it back. And the point is that once you've capsized, once you've got completely wet and you've remembered that the worst that can happen isn't really that bad, it then gives you confidence to sail much better and nearer to the limit when the race comes. And verse 11 invites us to do that same kind of thought experiment. What is the worst that can happen here if I'm public about my faith? And you think, well, I suppose really the worst that could happen would be I'd be killed. But actually, that's hardly the end of the world, is it? You know, after all, you know, the lamb's blood has sorted out any real problem on that. And I, you know, I would get raised again. And actually, even what looked like a defeat in the moment, the Lord, I know, would use it as a victory to puncture Satan's lie that might always wins and that resistance is useless. And once we've done that kind of capsized thought experiment, we're bulletproof. We can be brave in all kinds of much less scary environments than martyrdom. And we can start being bold about our faith. So just to recap, we saw already in paragraph one that Jesus, do you remember, he got carried up to heaven. And then we discovered that the woman who represents all of God's people through the Old and New Testament, she was left on earth in the wilderness. And we're now going to look at how her story continues from verse 13 onwards. This is the church's story. And one of the things we learn in this section is that the offer of relief whilst we're in the wilderness is tempting, but it's actually our greatest danger. So let's read from verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman, the church, who had given birth to the male child. And this is talking about how after Jesus' ascension, the devil tries to attack the church. But verse 14, the woman was given two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she's to be nourished for a time, times and half a time. Now, to the original hearers, this is a clear connection, isn't it, to Israel's experience when the Lord delivered Israel from Egypt in the days of Moses. Because when Israel gets to Sinai out in the wilderness in Exodus 19, the Lord says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings," chapter 19, verse 4, "and brought you to myself." It's the same image as here in verse 15. But this imagery is now given a twist in verse 15, because do you remember back in Exodus and then in Numbers, who was it who miraculously produced water out of a rock to provide relief in the desert? It was the Lord who did it. But listen to what happens to the church in verse 15. This time, verse 15, the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. So whereas in Exodus, it's the Lord who provides relief for his people, here in Revelation, it's the serpent trying to provide the relief. Actually, only what's going on here is it's all a big trick. The water the serpent produces looks like it's going to give relief in the desert, but actually it's intended to engulf her and to destroy her. We've already thought, haven't we, about how the devil has different tactics in different contexts. The obvious one is when he attacks us with a kick, and we know when that one's happening. It's not subtle, persecution. But the one perhaps we're more vulnerable to, in this country at least, is when he attacks more subtly with a kiss, when he offers us relief in the desert, something to drown our sorrows, something which will provide a release, an escape from this wilderness experience. And there were various flavours of this in the letters to the seven churches, temptations to fit in with the culture and avoid hostility, temptations to give in to immorality in various ways. I was thinking about this this week, and I'm very aware of how vulnerable we are in lockdown. Alongside all the various struggles we're experiencing right now, many of us have lost our normal Christian support structures. And then into this situation, the enemy is going to offer us some kind of relief. And it could be anything, you know, something obvious like drink and drugs or pornography. It could be something more subtle, which still takes over, something like addiction to TV or gaming or spending. But either way, instead of coming to the Lord for living water to keep us going in the wilderness and to give us that refreshment we need day to day, the temptation will be to look somewhere else for the water, for that relief. And the warning here is that offer of relief, whilst it looks very tempting, is actually our greatest danger spiritually. And it may end up sweeping us away entirely. That's the warning here. And the final hidden reality which this vision reveals to us is that the wilderness is tough, but actually it means that we're right on track. So let's keep going. Verse 15 again. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. So wonderfully, we discover the Lord comes to the help of his people and he rescues us from the serpent's counterfeit fake living water. And what's the outcome? We hope it's going to be, and then he led us into an oasis of peace and joy. But no, verse 17, it's not like that at all. Verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And here we discover that the result of faithfulness to God in chapter 12, the result of being one of those people who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus, what happens to us? Well, according to this verse, if that is us, we are one of the people who the dragon is furious with. We're one of the people that the dragon is determined to make war on. I think initially when you read this, it feels very discouraging. You know, you're discovering you're on Satan's target list. But actually, if you are someone who finds the Christian life difficult right now, this is a great, great comfort. Perhaps your relationships are much harder right now because of your faith. Perhaps you used to be the golden girl in the family or in your friendship group, but now, because of Jesus, you're the bad smell. Or perhaps you find the daily grind of just keeping going as a Christian, trying to resist temptation, you find it exhausting. And if that is you, then you can take heart. Suffering in the wilderness is tough. It feels like everything must have gone wrong somewhere. But actually, that is the sign that we are right on track and that we are on course for a wonderful destination. Where does the wilderness period end? Well, if we keep going, we get to the promised land, the land of milk and honey, the end of the journey, where, as chapter 21 of Revelation will outline for us, the place where the Lord will dwell with us forever. So as we close, we began with that question. Doesn't the church's weakness indicate that the devil is winning? And I hope we've seen today that John's vision has showed us behind the scenes of what is actually going on in this world, so that we don't lose heart and we don't give up the fight. I don't know what particular memories of 2020 you're likely to carry with you. But one that will certainly stick with me is switching on the radio in the kitchen on the 9th of November and hearing Sir John Bell, the Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford, break that news about the first vaccine. And of course, for most of us, it hasn't made any difference, has it? I mean, our daily experience at one level hasn't really improved that much since November. Things are still very, very hard. But on another level, what a difference it's made, knowing that now there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And for the Christian, the wilderness is tough. It was always meant to be tough. But we know that the devil has been thrown down. We know that his accusations will not have any traction anymore. And we know, therefore, that our future is secure. And so that means that you and I can keep going. We can keep persevering, knowing not just that there's, you know, a light at the end of the COVID tunnel, hopefully for many of us, but much more importantly, there is a promised land beyond all sickness, beyond all death, awaiting every one of us who will keep going.